Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to take a look at an often overlooked area of the global economy, Japan, the other Asian economy of great importance. Okay, what can we say about Japan? Well, it's the fourth largest economy in the world, first of all, and it's been in a funk economically for at least a quarter century. Japan, in some ways, represents a predictor of the global economy and its future trajectory. It's been stagnant at best for, since 1992. There was a major financial bust in 1991. We want to talk about why that happened. And then, of course, after the bust, there wasn't much recovery, if at all. Very brief periods of recovery. And there were subsequent banking crises that followed each of the collapses. There have been no fewer than seven recessions in Japan since 1992. Five, count them, four at least, maybe five, since 2008. In other words, stagnant recovery. Why is that? Why hasn't Japan been able to recover robustly in a sustained recovery since its big financial crash in 1991? That's a key question, because it kind of forecast what would happen to other major economies in the 21st century once they had a financial crash. And what we've seen in the Western economies and Japan since 2008 is a very, very weak, if any, recovery. It's varied a little bit from region to region. I mean, Europe, the Eurozone, has had a double dip, and you could even say a triple dip recession since 2008. Barely growing, and in some areas, like Italy and the periphery of Europe, there has been no real recovery. Those economies are still producing at less than they produced back in 2007. In other words, a decade later, they still haven't returned to at least the level of economic growth that they had in 2007. They're still below the curve. Italy, by the way, is a big weak spot in the Eurozone. We talked a little bit about Italian banks a week or so ago. $400 billion in non-performing loans just in Italy alone. Probably $1.5 trillion of non-performing loans throughout Europe. Over $1 trillion in Japan. China officially lists about $400 billion in non-performing loans. It's really far more than that. We don't have figures for the U.S. or the U.K., but probably significant as well. And then, of course, there's the emerging markets, Brazil, and so on and so forth. And you add all those up, I'll bet you there's more than $1 trillion in non-performing loans throughout the emerging markets as well. Huge, huge amount of loans made by banks to non-financial, non-bank corporations in which they aren't performing. Performing meaning that the companies that borrowed from the banks are not repaying on schedule, either principal, interest, or both. And the banks just aren't taking them to bankruptcy court, because that would cause even greater consternation and fear. And you would have even more collapse in terms of performance. and it would spill over to consumers as well. And the governments don't want to cause any more fear factor among consumers. There's enough of it right now, so they encourage the banks not to file bankruptcy proceedings for those companies that aren't paying their loans. But when those companies don't pay their loans and the banks aren't able to pursue bankruptcy or don't pursue bankruptcy, then you get losses on bank balance sheets. And if banks have losses, they get very conservative about lending further. And that, of course, slows down the economy. And it's a big reason why we see real investment by businesses globally, especially in advanced economies, real investment declining. In the U.S., real gross private domestic investment is down to 2% here in 2016. It was 12% a few years ago, down to 2%. Elsewhere, it's negative in the world. So we have a declining real investment going on as a result of all this globally. And that explains why you have a collapse in productivity going on. Without real investment, you don't get productivity growth. Sorry, you can't eke it out of creating more and more service jobs and hiring workers on a part-time temp contract basis. You just can't get productivity that way. And if you don't get productivity, then businesses say, oh, you know, I can't raise my prices or wages. And you get price deflation in real goods and services. And you get no wage growth, and therefore no consumption and no growth. So the problem with bank lending spills over, to summarize, to investment by businesses, which spills over to productivity problems, spills over to no wage increases, and deflation. And deflation is a big problem because if prices are falling, then businesses don't want to invest. I mean, why should they produce more and bring goods to market 6 months from now, the prices of which will probably be less than they estimated in their initial production costs? So they freeze up. And the same thing for workers with no wage increases. They don't spend. And you get this vicious negative cycle of going on. And we've traced the thread here of how all this works, but it feeds back into further reductions in real investment, further reductions in productivity. And if businesses are in that situation, they don't want to borrow. Banks don't want to lend because they got all this negative balance sheet going because it's non-performing loans. And businesses don't want to invest, therefore they don't want to borrow. So they banks have all this money, right? And to the extent they lend to companies, the companies don't invest it, you see. That's the problem. So the central banks keep pushing money, the money supply, into the system, and the money supply isn't getting into real investment. And therefore, real job creation, real productivity, real wage increases, and real consumption. It's not getting through the system. The system, the engine is broken. It's plugged up. It's clogged up. You know, it's like an old car, you know, with oil leaks, you know, through the cylinders and plugged up oil lines, and the oil leaks, of course, the money leaks, the oil leaks represent all this money oil being injected into the engine and leaking out into financial asset investments, leaking out into borrowing by businesses to pay dividends and stock buybacks, or just to sit on the cash. You know, there's a tremendous amount of money out there, but it's just sitting idle. Or idle money being used for very, very short-term investments in financial assets, stocks, bonds, derivatives, foreign exchange, and so forth. You know, because you can pull your money in and pull it out as an investor by investing in financial asset markets. You can watch them, and you can jump in, and you can jump out. Well, when you invest to produce something, you know, a factory and hire people and so forth, more uncertainty there, and you don't know your money's tied up long-term. You don't know you're going to get it out, right? That's why we see more and more investment plowing into financial asset markets and not enough getting into real investment projects. That's one of the major themes of my recent book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, by Clarity Press. Go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, and you can go from there to my website, and either there or Clarity Press website. You can read some free chapters. I've actually posted a few free chapters on my blog on China and Europe. China chapter title is Bubbles, Bubbles. China Bubbles, Bubbles, Toils and Troubles. And on Europe, it's Europe's Chronic Stagnation. There's a chapter I've written in the book as well on Japan, but I haven't put it up there, and that's something called Japan's Perpetual Recession. Well, yeah, I mean, if you're in recession, you know, 7-8 times in the last 2 decades, and especially 5 times since 2008, I mean, that's perpetual recession. What has been the answer to perpetual recession in Japan? Well, it's been the answer of other advanced economies since 2008, when Japan was doing this well before 2008. By the way, Japan is the originator of the idea of quantitative easing, right? Quantitative easing is where the central bank essentially prints money and buys bonds from private investors. Buys back bonds, government, if it's government bonds, buys them back. Right? Or, in the case of Japan's central bank, the Bank of Japan, they've gone further than any of the other central banks. And they're not only, they started the practice of buying corporate bonds. I mean, you buy government bonds for years and years. It's all these central banks have been doing since 2008. Pretty soon, you're buying up most of the bonds, most of the government bonds out there. What else are you going to do to pump money into the economy? Well, what you're going to do is you're going to start buying corporate bonds, which is, you know, what they've done in Europe and Japan. And now the UK, which has just introduced its second QE version here in the wake of the Brexit vote and the rapidly slowing British economy, just announced Mark Carney, the head of the Bank of England, just pumped in some money. And they're buying corporates now as well. I think, what is it, $70 billion a month or a year? I'm not sure which one, of Bank of England buying corporate bonds and government bonds. But they're starting to buy corporate bonds as well. Well, Japan's gone even further. How's that? Well, Japan is not only buying bonds, corporate and government, but they're buying stocks and real estate funds. They're running out of stuff to buy, so they're buying up stocks now and real estate. Well, don't you think all that demand, all that buying of bonds and stocks and property funds, don't you think that increased demand is driving up the price of stocks and bonds and real estate funds? Well, of course. So all this QE and central bank monetary injection has the effect of stimulating prices, but prices of financial assets, not prices of goods and services, because the engine is leaking out, and it's leaking out, you know, into financial assets, or it's plugging up the engine and just hoarding a cash. I mean, the capitalist global economic engine is really sputtering. You know, it needs a general overhaul. Or maybe we need to replace the whole engine. Take it out, put another one in. Because it's just not firing on all cylinders anymore. And you can see problems, especially in Europe and in Japan. Emerging markets, oh, they flip-flopped. And all the, you know, everything going on in emerging markets is just a function of the U.S. dollar and U.S. interest rates. When it looks like the Fed is not going to raise interest rates, oh, the money from wealthy investors floods into emerging markets. And they recover a little bit. But then it looks like the Fed's going to raise rates. And all the money flows out, and emerging markets are in trouble. So we get this volatility going on down there in emerging markets. And that's why the capitalists, particularly in Latin America, you know, with the help of the U.S., decided to pull off some coups, some business coups, coup d'etats, right? And they did that in Argentina, right? There's a strategy of how you do that with claiming corruption and wrecking the economies with the help of the U.S. dollar and foreign direct investment and cause economic crises and problems. And then you get your right-wing conservative corporate parties taking over the government one way or another, if not legally, then illegally. We see that in Brazil right now with that phony coup, parliamentary legal coup d'etat going on in Brazil right now. And what do the new corporate parties down there do when once they get in power? Oh, they cut deals, financial deals, and enrich themselves significantly, which is what they've done in both those countries. Stock markets boom, bond markets do well, right? And the rich get richer because they get rich off of these capital incomes and these financial assets, and the rest of the economy and citizens end up with more unemployment and more import goods inflation. In other words, collapse the standard of living. So it's a shift of income. You know, it's a redistribution of income. Right? We see the same effort attempted going on in Venezuela right now. But they haven't quite pulled that off yet. But that's all a conscious policy. The U.S. Cooperating. I mean, to take the case of Venezuela. The U.S., which controls the dollar, and U.S. corporations down there and banks have put the squeeze on Venezuela. They've made sure that dollars don't flow into Venezuela and done everything they can to ensure dollars flow out of Venezuela. And with Venezuela depending 95% of its government revenues on the sale of global oil, of course, and global oil prices collapsed to $40, then they can't raise enough money. And when the dollars are flowing out, you get shortages of goods because Venezuela doesn't produce a lot of consumer goods of its own. And people can't buy goods because there aren't enough dollars. And the U.S. Sets up in Colombia, for example, a operation next door, which encourages dollar outflows from Venezuela to invest in this new online investment vehicle there, website, so forth. So you know, it's a kind of a multifaceted policy to cause dollar flight out of Venezuela that causes shortages, causes inflation. And therefore, you have the basis for, oh, an economic crisis, government can't manage the economy. Let us, the corporate business elite, take over again. Right? That's the model. And it's because the dollar is a global currency, a very powerful weapon U.S. wields here with the global trading and reserve currency, the dollar. That's why they're doing everything they can to prevent China from developing its currency, the yuan, as a global reserve currency as well. But that's a long-term battle, and they haven't been too successful so far, but it's just beginning. Okay, so we've drifted a little bit from the main theme here, but let's get back to that, which is global central banks, i.e., particularly Japan, pumping money into the global economy, and it's like overfilling your auto engine with excess oil. It spills out. You know, it leaks, but when you put too much in too quick, it also spills out. And that spill out, of course, is taking the form of hoarding and financial asset investing and so forth, you know. The whole idea in Japan of its central bank policy was to drive up the price of financial assets, and therefore investors would get rich from their Japanese investors and others get rich from their financial investments, and they would use some of it to invest in the Japanese economy and get the real economy going again. Well, typically what's happened is financial assets have risen. As I said, Japan invented the QE and then has expanded QE to buying stocks and real estate funds. So the money's been pumped in, but it's flowed right back out, leaked out of Japan, as Japanese corporations have used the money to invest abroad, not in Japan, per se. So they're not getting the real economic growth in Japan. And if you don't get real economic growth from real investment, what you get is deflation and no wage growth, and that affects consumptions, as we described. And that's exactly what's been happening in Japan for decades now. Right. But the monetary policy, folks, you know, the capitalists love monetary policy. You know, pump the money into us. And we'll dribble it down, maybe, to real investment, jobs, income, consumption, maybe, right? But when, you know, globally, it's so lucrative to invest in these financial asset markets and, you know, less risky because you can move your money out so quick, and it's all price appreciation. You don't have to sell things on volume to make profits. You know, that's a great alternative for capitalists. They love that. And so what if people don't have jobs, and so what if productivity falls, and so what, you know? We're making our bucks. And that's what's been happening in Japan. The money's been flowing out. They've also hoped that somehow the Japan policymakers, pumping money in will cause their stock price, not the stock price, their price of real goods, consumer price index, etc., to decline. In other words, devalue their currency. Well, it hasn't quite happened that way. It happened briefly, but then Japanese prices have escalated again. In fact, Japan's currency, the yen, is up 16% against the dollar just this year. So we have a price exchange rate currency appreciation going on in Japan, even though it's pumping trillions of dollars into its economy. Just announced, you know, back earlier this year, another major monetary injection through a central bank. So, in other words, the QE stuff is not working anymore, at least not insofar as driving down currency and generating exports and therefore export-driven economic growth. You know, it's not resulting in investment, business investment economic growth. Investment has declined in Japan here 5 months in a row, I think. It's not resulting in that. And it certainly isn't resulting in rising wages and standard of living and therefore consumption. So business investment and household consumption is not growing. The other alternative would be government spending to get the economy going and or more export sales to get the economy going. But when your currency exchange rate rises, you're not as competitive, and therefore you're not stimulating exports. So the only other alternative to get economic real growth going is government spending. Ah, but the policymakers who want to do all central bank monetary injection, in other words, the bankers and wealthy investors who control the policy, they don't want to do fiscal stimulus. They don't want to stimulate the economy because, look, if you're going to stimulate the economy by government spending, what you're doing is focusing on Main Street and the real economy to get incomes and spending up by the general populace, and the idea there being that that would stimulate then business investment subsequently. So it's generating economic growth. Fiscal spending means generating economic growth from a different direction than monetary central bank money injection. Right? The money injection goes right into the hands immediately of wealthy investors and financial institutions, and then maybe some of it dribbles down. Well, not much is dribbled down, as we said, right? If you do it fiscally, you're doing it just the opposite. In other words, the financial investors and wealthy investors have to wait on the economy and the regular consumer and worker to start spending before they get some of it. You know, that's like a bubble up from Main Street households to the wealthy. They don't want to bubble up. You know, they want, give me all the money now, and maybe I'll share some of it. That's monetary policy, you see. Fiscal policy is just the opposite. Pump money into government spending and programs, pump it into the general populace, and hope that it stimulates wealth for the wealthy. Well, they want it quick, you see. They want quick fix, the wealthy and investors. They want quick fix. Give us the money now. And, oh, so what if we hoard some of it, you know, don't use it or send it offshore, or we pump it, redirect it into financial assets rather than the real economy. So what? We'll get rich. And that's been the story of QE and central bank policy since 2008. Before that, in the case of Japan, you see, Japan's been the harbinger of things to come for some time. It hasn't worked in Japan for a quarter century. Well, why did they think it would work in 2008? Well, the whole idea of pumping money into the economy was, through central banks, was that some of it would get used, but not much of it got used for real investment. That was the problem, you see. It got hoarded and it got redirected elsewhere to emerging markets, and a lot of it got directed into financial investing. Ah, so what did central banks do? Well, they said, well, we need to pump some more, maybe, you know, if it's broke. We should let it break some more. Throw some more money down the black hole. And that's what the central banks are doing. Well, double down. If the policy has failed, double down and do more of it. And that's the reality of monetary policy, central bank injection, QE, quantitative easing, pump the money in, and hope some of it gets down. Well, now they're realizing that less and less is getting down, less and less. And not only is less of it, the so-called trickle-down is now, you know, barely a drip. I mean, the evidence is declining real asset investments and productivity and wage growth and et cetera. Consumers keep spending, even though they're not getting wage increases, because they keep throwing more debt at them. Go buy on debt. Take out more debt. Households, a good example in the U.S., of course, is auto sales. You know, and huge auto debt run up, and that's kept the U.S. economy growing a little faster than the rest in the last few years, this boom in auto sales. But it's all debt-driven, you see. Auto debt is now well over $1 trillion in the U.S. Education debt, the same thing, $1.3 trillion. Credit card debt rising rapidly. Well, that's how they've kept for average median income folks, kept their consumption going. It hasn't been because of wage increases. All this talk about wage increases in the U.S., 2.5%. That's been all skewed to the top. Certain industries like tech and high-end folks making six figures. It's been stagnant or less at the median. Okay, so early in this year, what are the consequences of all this Japanese injection, which has led the way with QE and then, expanding record? I mean, the latest injection by the Bank of Japan, given the size of its economy, was much greater than even the U.S. monetary injection, given the size of its economy. But its economy has continued to shrink. The Japanese economy in 2011 was equivalent to $5.9 trillion. Today, it's $4.1 trillion. Yeah, that's what it's worth. So all this super record monetary injection by Japan, the extreme example of monetary policy, a central bank monetary policy and liquidity money injection, the result has been a continued long-term contraction of the economy. Doesn't work. Doesn't work for generating the real economy. It works for wealthy folks. Wealthy investors, they keep pocketing this stuff hand over fist. But it's not generating the real growth. And it's even worse than that. Because now it's not only barely a drip, it's causing severe problems. Negative returns on this kind of a policy that's been going on now for 8 years. What are the negative returns? Well, you drive down interest rates to record low levels. I mean, if you're pumping that much money into the economy, I mean, just supply and demand, you got excess supply of money, excess. Well, what happens when you increase the supply of anything according to economic basic theory? Well, you lower the price of it. Right? And that's exactly what's been happening. We've, injecting all this money. Right? You're lowering the price. All right, so what else has happened here? Well, the price, the interest rates have gone down. And they've gone down so far, they're in negative territory. The price of money is just the interest rate. That's all the interest rate is the price of money. And when, the price has turned negative interest rates, in other words, what happens with negative interest rates? Well, you got tens of millions, will take the U.S. loan, tens of millions of families and people in retirement, and even pre-retirement, and if they can't earn any savings on basic interest, and they're not, what do? Well, they save even more, is what happens. They try to make up for the low interest rate by increasing the amount of money that they're saving. Well, if you increase your savings efforts, right, you're going to spend less. Because, look, your income, your disposable income, it do two things with it. You can save it or you can spend it. Right? Well, if you get low interest rates or negative rates, we'll talk about that soon, what happens? Well, people desperately try to save even more. Well, if you save more, that means that you're consuming less. If you're consuming less, it slows down the economy. Unless you want to borrow, right? Save your real money and go into deeper debt for your expenditures. Now, not only consumers and households do that, but businesses do that too, right? they try to save, in other words, hoard cash more, which reduces their real investment. Their spending, business spending. So you get a parallel thing going on. Low negative rates increase savings efforts. Increasing savings, whether businesses or households, increasing savings reduces consumption or investment. Reduce investment, reduce consumption, right? There you go. That's a problem. So it's becoming negative. Negative interest rates, the whole idea of negative interest rates, which exists now in Europe and in Japan, the negative interest rates were supposed to send the signal to businesses, central banks sending the signal to businesses saying, hey, look, you know, you got to pay us to park your money with us. Why don't you just invest it? That's the signal central bank to other private banks. Why don't you just invest it? You know, it's going to cost you money to park it with us, bankers and investors. So just invest it out. Well, that was such a stupid idea. It's hard to believe. No, it's not. These people are really dumb out there in policy land. Think that would stimulate investment? And lending, bank lending, it's done just the opposite. Because it's a signal, oh, something must be wrong with the economy, global economy, so people start hoarding more money, businesses hoard more cash, households hoard more cash to the extent they got to, you know, spend, they borrow more. And more people get in debt. And more businesses get in debt, and you're going to pay that piper. When the next recession comes, you're going to have an excess load of debt and no income because your income and prices are going to fall in a recession even further, and you can't service that debt. And guess what? Non-performing loans is the consequence of negative interest rates. Non-performing loans, hoarding of cash, excess savings, not consuming, not investing. Just the opposite of what they thought negative rates would do, cause more investment. No, it's causing less investment. And the proof is, you know, the data on declining investment. And following that, as I said before, you get declining real prices. Declining real prices freezes investment and consumption up even more. It's a vicious downward cycle, you know. But, you know, some of these capitalists know this. They know this, but there's so much pressure to pump money into their friends' hands, investor friends' hands, that they can't back off of it. They've become, the whole system has become addicted to free money. I wrote about that almost 3 years ago. Are central banks becoming addicted? Is business becoming addicted to free money? Yeah, they're addicted. It's a form of economic dope, opioids. It's economic opioid. They can't get off of it. And the deeper and longer they go with this, the withdrawal is going to be even harder. You know, once they start, real estate rates, watch. There's going to be a very quick negative response to higher interest rates and going to throw the economy into a recession. I predict 2017 recession coming, U.S. Now, this time it's going to be worse around because the whole global economy is so fragile. I mean, there's no growth in world trade. It's totally stagnant. Not growing at all. World trade and GDP, you know, because it emphasizes over-optimistically is about 2%, according to the World Bank. 2% growth, if that. China's economy is slowing far more rapidly than they're reporting. UK now is now in recession. Stagnation growth pretty much in Europe. In the U.S., limping along at somewhere between 1.5% to 1.8% growth. That's the global picture. So now, you know, the realization is growing that QE policy and negative interest rates, which is the flip side of all this money injection, QE drives down the price of money, interest rates, is not only not working the way it's supposed to stimulate the economy, real economy, but it's having negative effects. It's becoming counterproductive, you know, by increasing savings because of the low rates and freezing up investment. It's having the opposite effect of its intended theoretical effect. So now what's happened, I can see signs emerging here and there in different sources of the global capitalist system where they're beginning to say, gee, maybe we have to do some fiscal spending here. You know, we got to do something about this because you know, the monetary thing after 8 years has run its course. What can we do? You know, well, there's increased interest in infrastructure spending. Both in Europe and Japan, and now we see it reflected in the two candidates for president in the U.S. You know, they're talking about both of them infrastructure spending. Something like that is coming. There will be more infrastructure spending after the first of the year. And, you know, Japan and Europe are watching the U.S. They're keying off the U.S. And they say, we can't do that unless the U.S. does it. Or Japan says, you know, we can't stimulate our economy fiscally, you know, unless Europe and the U.S. do it too. Because if we do it, it will drive up the value of our currency and reduce our exports, and we'll be less competitive. We can't do it by ourselves. You know, a recent G7 meeting in Japan, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe pleaded with the rest of his G7 friends and said, please fiscally stimulate your economy so we can. You know, he can't stimulate it. Well, you know, they just announced a stimulus package. Abe pre-announced it, saying it would be worth $270 billion. Well, it came out to be $132 billion. So there are, you know, forces behind Abe that made him back off. It will be some infrastructure spending and some cash handouts to very low income. You know, they're getting to such a point globally here in advanced capitalist economies that there's been such poor wage and income growth that they're going to now have to hand out money. Which brings up all this talk about helicopter money. And Abe was talking, or actually Kuroda, who was the central bank chairman of Bank of Japan over there, had speculated in publicly about helicopter money might be needed. It's a form of fiscal stimulus, you see, helicopter money. But they didn't follow up with that in their announcement in Japan recently of the $132 billion. But it put on the table this idea of helicopter money, and it's being talked about, you know, in the U.S. and in the U.K. and so forth. Well, once again, we mentioned briefly what helicopter money was. We'll have a show on that at some point. But basically, it's this. It's the central bank prints money, just as it does for QE, but instead of using the money to buy bonds or stocks, you know, from private investors and banks, right? What the central bank does is prints money, right, and buys bonds from the government. It's government. So the government gets actual money, right, that it then uses to spend in the economy, fiscal spending, right, through various programs. Now, these bonds are sometimes called perpetual bonds. In other words, the central bank buys bonds issued by the Treasury called perpetual bonds. Perpetual meaning they never have to be paid back, you see. They're there as sort of a marker for the money that's been created. doesn't add to government debt at all, you see. So it's nice that way. They don't have to pay themselves back, right? I mean, the government does not have to pay back its central bank. But the money gets put in, kind of like QE for Main Street, you might say, depending if the government then fiscally spends on Main Street, you know. I recently made a recommendation. I advise Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein, and Jill had asked, you know, how do we reform this whole student debt thing? You know, $1.3 trillion of student debt in the United States. So I said, you know, it's not too difficult to introduce some sort of U.S. Central Bank Fed policy akin to helicopter money, buy some special education bonds, right, from the U.S. government, from the Treasury, and the U.S. Government can then use that money to help the $1.3 trillion students in debt pay down that debt. Because now it's so huge, you know, when they get out of college, they got tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt. They can't, from their income, they can't really spend it, you know, to buy homes or stimulate the economy or to get married or get in their own apartment or anything. You know, the students who just graduate, they're in excess debt because they have these huge payments, you know, $500, $600, $700. At the same time, they're getting jobs that are poorly paid. So they're getting whacked, millennials, from both ends. Well, what the government can do is create these bonds and pay the debt, pay down the debt, or make the payments, the monthly payments for students in debt, to free up some of their own income to spend on real consumption elsewhere, stimulate the economy. You know, so the U.S. government, the Treasury, pays the Department of Education for these loans. You know, it's just moving numbers around from one part of the government budget to another part of the government budget. That's all it is. It can be done. It's very easy. Right? Focus on the debt payments of those who have been making their payments or who are deferring their payments because they have no income, no job. Right? Don't necessarily pay for those who are in arrears. You have to come up with some other solution for those in default because you don't want to pay money, make payments for people in default because that's an excuse for people to default, you see. But that's just a technical administrative thing to resolve. But, you know, you could quickly pay down most of that trillion-dollar debt, trillion-plus dollar student debt, and leave, households that have this huge debt overhang to spend it elsewhere. We got to do that at some point. Well, you know, we've been doing it to multi-trillion dollars for bankers and investors since 2008. Well, why can't we do it a little bit for Main Street here? You know? You could do this not only for student debt, but for homeowners who are, you know, still deep in the negative equity, and you could do it for a number of different programs. Right. Now, that money would get spent. It would not get hoarded. It would get spent, unlike QE money being hoarded by banks and investors. All right, so that's helicopter money. Some version of that is coming, right? Some version. And they were talking about it in Japan, but they put it on hold, right? They even, the Kuroda there, the chair of the Bank of Japan, even invited Ben Bernanke, Shinzo Abe, the Prime Minister, invited Ben Bernanke to come over and talk about it, right? Bernanke supports some idea of this, you know? Paul Krugman, who I critiqued a number of times on the show, supports the idea. I support the idea. Why not QE for Main Street? About time. But the people who run the policies, you know, they don't like this idea. that you're not going to give them the money. You're going to give the money to somebody else, and maybe the somebody else will spend it, and the money will get back to them somehow, you know, dribble up. No, they like trickle down, drip down. Right. It can't be done. It's just, you know, political stranglehold of the super wealthy on the system, including economic policy going on right now. Just a commentary once again on this negative rate thing, which is a big problem, not working the way it's supposed to, right? And negative rates actually being counterproductive now. What's really worrisome is the escalation pace, the acceleration pace in negative interest rate securities going on. You know, before 2015, there were no negative rates on any corporate or government bond rates. There were no negative rates at all. There was no such thing. In 2015-16, in a, you know, an 18-month period, two-year, 24, 18-month period, all of a sudden we had, as of May of this year, $11 trillion in global negative rates. A trillion. $11 trillion. I mean, negative rates are consequences of excess liquidity injection by central banks going overboard, driving prices to negative territory. Well, just since May, in other words, in the wake of the Brexit UK situation, just since May, that $11 trillion has risen to $13 trillion. It's rising at a rate of $1 trillion a month, negative rates. And, of course, now it's still limited to bond rates. But as central banks keep buying stocks and real estate funds, it's going to spill over to these other financial securities as well. Okay, so that's, negative interest rates, big, big problem. Theory does not work. It wasn't theory, it's economic ideology. In other words, using economics to justify giving the rich and wealthy even more money. You see, that's the difference between economic ideology and economic science. Economic ideology is you use economic analyses and ideas to justify a policy that enriches and benefits some. They know it's not going to work, but they come up with a nice sounding theory. That's what a lot of economics is. You know, it's really economic ideology. It's not really economic science. And negative rates are in that category. You know, most of monetary policy, QE, is in that category, too. There's far more economic ideology than there is economic science out there. But to the uninitiated, it sounds logical. It sounds reasonable, these arguments. You know, if you make people... investors pay to put money with the central bank, their alternative, they'll want to use it somewhere else rather than pay and not use it. But no, they pumped it. They keep buying, in very risky areas like Japan and Europe, they keep paying the government to buy their bonds at negative rates. Well, why is that? I mean, that doesn't make logical sense, does it? Yes, it does. Because they feel if they invested elsewhere, they might lose even more money, you see. It's all about rates of return and expected rates of return. Keynes talked about this 70 years ago, but no one pays any attention to it anymore. Why do businesses invest? Is it because the cost of money is so low or negative? Low? Is that why they invest? No, they invest based on expected rates of return, profitability. And the profitability is declining, and rates of return are declining. It doesn't matter how cheap. You can give them money for nothing, and it won't be borrowed. because there's no way, expected way of making profits off of that borrowing. Investment is a function of more than just the cost of money. Oh, but they borrow it. Yeah, they borrow. But what are they borrowing it for? Not for investing. They're borrowing this free money to buy back their stock and pay record dividends to their shareholders, i.e. themselves. Or just to sit on it. Hoard it. That's what they're borrowing from. But by borrowing, you are adding to your debt. And therefore, future payments on your debt, principal and interest, you're going to have to make at some point. So in the good times now, quote, good times, relative, they're loading up on debt. Businesses are loading up on debt. Households are beginning to begin to load up on debt, throwing credit cards at, cards at folks, and student debt and auto debt and so forth, right? They're loading up on debt. And when the next recession comes and income and prices collapse, they won't have a way to pay that debt because the debt doesn't go away. You still got to pay principal and interest on the debt you borrowed in good times. When the bad times come and you don't have the income to make the payments, then what happens? Well, the banks either have to roll over your debt, say, okay, you know, we'll just continue, or bankruptcy. In other words, they'll take what assets you got. Ah, but see, that's very risky because if you have too many bankruptcies, then people panic and asset prices, stocks, and bonds collapse even more. Now you're in a big, vicious downward spiral, a la 2008-09. Yeah, that's what happens. Okay, so Japan, watch Japan. Japan is pleading infrastructure spending. Let's have some more fiscal policy. And they're all moving towards that. You're going to see 2017 because they got to raise interest rates. It's causing negative problems elsewhere. The Fed will raise interest rates after the November elections, but that risks slowing down the economy even more into a recession in 2017. So what they're going to do is say, well, we're going to raise interest rates that will slow down the economy. We're going to pump up fiscal spending to offset that slowdown. I.e. infrastructure spending coming. Fiscal policy will turn expansionary as monetary policy turns contractionary. But you know what? It's not going to work. Okay.